Hi, Mackenzie.
Hi, Lamar.
Still got classics on the mind, but before we get to talking about motion pictures again, I was wondering, do you have a favorite classic rock group or classic? I guess it could be any genre of music, but what do you think?
I don't know why you give me these types of questions where I have to make decisions, because I'm really bad at it.
I
I'm really
have
bad at picking one.
26 favorite classic rock groups.
I have a minimum of three in each genre, and I have a monologue as to why for each
Let's
one. I
stick to like
apologize.
rock slash like pop. We'll even call Beatles classic rock, right? Like anything Beatles and beyond.
Okay, well, to be fair, I would say one, yes, classic rock in general is one of my favorite genres. So it's a good one to
Okay.
pick. Classic rock, jazz, those are my faves. But in general, I lots of great artists. Mine is probably, if I had to pick one, it would be very much a nostalgic pick, which is they have actually changed genres a couple of times, but they were the reason I referenced them is that they were my first favorite band. And they were a classic rock band when they started, and then they kind of evolved into like being a little prog rocky later in their
Okay.
existence. But they are the band known as Yes, was my first favorite band.
Yes. Very nice. Very nice. What were their
My
biggest? I was
poor
never.
family like hated that they were my favorite band because they had to hear it all on repeat all the
What
time.
was their biggest single? I'm trying to remember. They have a bunch of hits, but like.
They have a bunch. They did like Roundabout is one that they're known for. Owner of a Lonely Heart, State of Play. Like
Okay.
they have a lot that they were. But they again they have like ones of different eras. So like they have like 60s hits, 70s hits that are really different than their 80s hits, which are like when they're more leaning into like the synth and the keys of the time, right? And so, but they were incredible musicians. So they were able to really, kind of translate across genres, I think, on the whole, even though their bassist was an asshole.
Okay,
But they were
well.
real good. How about you?
Well, first of all, I guess I'm gonna have to. I'm here in Florida with my family for the Thanksgiving holiday, and my dad has a bunch of speakers outside, and every night he just goes out and like listens to music and kind of rocks out by himself on the porch. So I might have to go out and throw on some Yes
First of
tonight and
all,
see.
that's adorable.
Yeah, see,
That
he's
is
retired.
adorable.
That's a great way. That's how I plan to spend my retirement. Just listen to
Fuck
music and
yeah.
have a
I
drink on the
love that
porch.
for him. Yes,
Yeah.
play him some yes. Ask him his thoughts. I would love to hear.
Very nice. For me, I think it's weird because I didn't. I mean, I knew who they were, but I did not discover them until I was already 20 years old or so. But Led Zeppelin, like
Oh,
I
fuck
fucks
yeah.
with Led Zeppelin now. Like,
Who doesn't fucks with some Led Zeppelin? Like, if
I
you
don't.
haven't fucks with some Led Zeppelin, you're doing it wrong.
I will say the one caveat is that I don't know that I've ever done a full Zeppelin album from front to back. Like, I'm sure they're. I know they have three or four that people swear by, but
What?
like, I can listen to their singles
Led
consecutive,
Zeppelin
but I.
four is
That's
like
the
the
one that
legend.
everyone's.
That's the
Yeah.
legendary
Yeah.
one that at minimum. But I mean, they're all, this is the era of albums. You are supposed to listen to the album. Like
Yeah.
they're
They were
all of
designed
them. You
that
could,
way.
yeah.
There was an art
That's
to
a
it.
good
Yeah.
one.
Thank
That's
you.
a good
Thank
one.
you. Yeah.
Good choice.
All right. Now let's
Okay,
talk
now
about
we have
something
to
that has
talk about
nothing to do with that.
completely unrelated. Exactly what I was going to say. Hard left turn. Let's fucking go. Welcome back to We Drink and We Watch Things. I'm
I'm
Mackenzie.
Lamar, and we're going to talk over each other all day today, just like they do in this movie, you see?
I did not get the heads up on this, or we could have totally done this. I'm ready to fucking go. I'm ready to talk 240 words per minute. Let's fucking move.
Oh, good God. There's so many interruptions, so much ad-libbing, the chaos of this. It's like an Always Sunny episode. It's just loud noises, lots of talking over each other.
So fucking good.
Very entertaining, though.
It's so entertaining. Yeah, it is. Okay, we'll get there, but there is so much to be said about this continued classic. We are starting in week two of this month with His Girl Friday, one of my absolute faves.
You had
Absolute
mentioned
faves.
this even before we started doing the podcast. I think one of the first conversations you and I had when we were getting to know each other, I asked what your favorite movies were, and you pointed out that a lot of them I probably wouldn't have heard of. And you were right. And His Girl Friday made the list. So I'm excited to have finally watched it.
Yes, two of my favorite movies are making appearances this month,
Nice.
and this is one of them. And it's because it's hard, as we've established, for me to pick one. But I definitely have like a top five or a top 10, and this is in it. And it is. It's so like ripe with with this witty repartee and banter, and like, and they just are so quick moving, and I just love it. So anyways, to power us through this, because it's going to move fast, what are we drinking?
Well, like we said last week, we're sticking to the classic cocktails this month, so we're not going to overcomplicate things, and we want to make it easier on you guys out there who want to do some drinking at home and not have to pay $14 at an Austin bar for a basic cocktail. You just make yourself, drink at home alone. I do
so
it.
So simple. So simple. Right. It's not drinking alone if, what is the insert cat, dog, whatever is here. That's... Yeah. Pay for effort.
But yeah, so we're sticking to the classics today. We're going to just do an old fashioned because we're watching some old fashioned films. And yeah, if you've never made your own old fashioned at home, all you need is bourbon or rye, 2 ounces of that, 2 to 3 dashes of bitters. I mean, there's a million different flavors of bitters. I think Angostura is the basic one.
Orange is recommended. Yeah.
Yeah. And then whatever you're using as your sugar. So you can use regular sugar, brown sugar, simple syrup, agave I've seen. Like there's a bunch of different stuff, honey. But you need a sweetener in there, just like 0.25 ounces of that. You stir it all up. If you're feeling fancy, you throw a cherry in there. But what's your go-to? Do you have a specific bourbon or rye that you like using?
I swear I didn't do this on purpose because I didn't know you were going to ask me this, but it's Brothers Bond is what I did today, which is the one that I have mentioned several
Deadpool
times and been
Wolverine,
like,
yeah.
Yes. And I've been like, please sponsor us because we love you. Cause I really do love it. Mm-hmm. It's really great by itself, but it is great in an old fashioned, but yeah. I think like if you have any decent bourbon is fine, but like, you know, there it's going to come out good. But I personally think that the Brothers Bond is so smooth and nice. And
that's what I was going to point out was for old fashions. I've heard it both ways. I've heard some people say you don't want to use a really expensive, classy bourbon because yeah. you're diluting it with sugar yeah. and bitters. I've heard yeah. other people, but you also don't want to go super cheap because it
yeah.
is almost a straight drink. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So you,
yeah.
I like middle ground. I've been doing Buffalo Trace, which is kind of hard to find nowadays. It's like, there's
really?
A shortage. Yeah, they're not keeping up with demand because they're booming at the moment. So if you can find it in stores, it's really good and it's moderately priced. So I think that's
it's funny.
Why
I went right past the Buffalo Trace to get to the Brothers Bond in the cabinet
because next time it might not be there.
No, I have some, but I went for this. Okay. But I have a fuck ton of bourbon, so I have a lot of them. But yeah, and I will say put mine in my classic films lowball, which I thought was appropriate for today. And this was my grandfather's glass. So anyway, cheers.
Oh, well, cheers to grandpa.
Mm-hmm. Grandpa, who actually didn't like movies at all, which is why it is hilarious to
you know
me
what?
That he owned those
Fuck
glasses.
He would have hated this podcast.
He would have hated this podcast. He really would have. He would have been so proud of me. He would have been like, good job, mijita, but I hate it. But I'm going to drink out of your glass. Thanks, Gramps. Well, we are going to dig into this one. Oof, I love it so much. And really, on the whole, it is very beloved as well. This is His Girl Friday, 1940, 7.8 out of 10 on IMDb, 99% from critics, 90% from audiences, which that's not a huge disparity by any means. It's still 90% plus, of course, right? But I do think some of that stems from what you already said, which is that it is a lot to follow. But it's incredible. So we'll get into some of these. Again, I'm going to give you some of the simple stuff on these folks because probably won't know a lot of what they've done before. But Howard Hawks is our director, who has done a few things that you probably have heard of. He's actually a really prolific classic film director who was not particularly well celebrated in his time, funnily enough, given the ones that he's done, including but not limited to The Big Sleep, Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. These were big hits for context, if you didn't know. Bringing Up Baby, which actually is not my favorite, but is a big hit. El Dorado, To Have and Have to Have Not. These are all his work. And he was really prolific. He did he directed 87 films or something like that and produced another 30 something. Really incredible.
Yeah, you're talking about how he wasn't really recognized until after his time. I had read something where he was actually slated to direct Casablanca, but he decided to trade places. I guess that's something directors can do. Just, hey, you take this, I'll take this with Michael Curtis, who ended up directing that, just because I guess they both knew the corresponding subject matter better. They were struggling to get a vision for their film, so he didn't end up directing Casablanca for that reason.
Which again is a little bit a product of the studio system, right? The studio system was built to plug people in and out of whatever it was, you know, writing, directing, acting. Like it was, you have a backfill for everything. And there are, you know, four or five Cary Grants as far as they were concerned, which of course, is, as we know today, is not true. There's only one Cary fucking Grant. But there were types. Like there were types like that. And they would just plug you in. And it was true of directors as well. So, but he did some really incredible things that people have, you know, again, to this day have seen, heard a million times because they're so well done. The writers on this one, Charles Lederer did the screenplay, and he's known for also Gentlemen Prefer Blondes. He did a couple others. He did, was one of the ones on who had contributed to The Thing from Another World. And so he's actually done a fair amount, but he, same thing, was just did a ton of films, wrote on a ton of films, Kiss of Death, a couple others.
He wrote Ocean's 11. So Brad Pitt.
He did.
No, I'm kidding. He wrote the original Ocean's
11. The original.
The one from way back in the day. So if you like Ocean's 11, he wrote the original one.
Yeah, which if you didn't know, yeah, is based an adaptation of the, it's, I think it's 1960 is the, 60 or 61 is the original for Ocean's 11. He did do that. Yeah. And then we had Ben Hecht and Charles MacArthur, who co-wrote the play, which was The Front Page, published in 1928. And they did.
It's been made into so many movies.
It has. So, I mean, again, like I made this joke in when we were talking about our last film, which was that the newspaper man role was so sexy at the time. And it really was, like, it was a shtick. There were a lot of like newspaper man stories. Investigative journalism was interesting, was, you know, kind of hot. It was also really an honorable profession because there was a lot of watchdog journalism happening at this time and investigative journalism, which was intended to hold people in power to account for things that were not okay. Right. So
be nice if we still had that. That'd be awesome.
Wouldn't that be incredible if that was a thing that we did? Yeah. So it was a really reputable profession and one that also did look and feel like fast moving, sexy, interesting. And so, yeah, there's a lot of films where this is at least partially the premise or the character is a newspaper editor, writer, reporter, what have you. So now, that was the source
really
material.
Quickly about the source material. I think I have two points to touch on. The first we mentioned last week, and that is that this actually is obviously based on a stage play. And this one feels like a stage play at times where they have a total of like, it feels like four set pieces in this. It feels like we're always in these same locations,
these core locations.
And we're having these long 15, 20 minutes, 10 to 15 minute scenes within there. It just feels as though, and it's a product of its time too, of like when film was new, people were still approaching it as though it was a theatrical performance where they're doing big hand gestures and they're being very loud and they're talking as if they're trying to project to a live audience when that's not the case, obviously, anymore. And then over time, like in cinema, you get more into the subtleties of like, you don't have to do everything. Sometimes just a little twitch of your eye or a little facial mannerism is enough. And so obviously this one just feels much more to me like a play, like a direct adaptation of a play than the one we did last week.
Yeah. I mean, it's funny because the play, the source material, The Front Page, is a really popular play. It was very well received. It was really well written. And actually even Howard Hawks says it's some of the best dialogue he's ever heard, ever seen written. But they ended up rewriting like half of it for, I think it's literally about half was rewritten for the film, even though he loved the original. And there's a number of reasons for that. They changed, the original source material is actually two men. It's an editor and a reporter.
I would have liked that better. Just going to say that. I did the love story in this is the one, I was just like, if you take that out, this is so good. Even if it's still a man and a woman, but you take out the love story or even just her coming back to him, like spoiler, like it just fell flat in that aspect. I was watching it. Like, I think I'd read that fact. I was 15 minutes in the movie and I had the little fun facts pulled up and saw that. And I started listening to the dialogue from that perspective and it became a lot clearer. And I know, and even, I think they remade this in 74, something like that, with Walter Matthau, Jack Lemmon, Susan Sarandon. And in that they went with the two male leads. And I believe that the one is leaving to go get married, but he's convincing him to stay for the story. So the plot stays the same. I just, that the love story was a little disconnected for me.
I like it. I think it lands. I think it's, I also really do, I could see it without the love story though, but I still want it to be a woman is what I would say. Like, I love that her character is a woman. I think that they, so Howard Hawks, for context, he had actually had it read out loud and a woman took the lines of the reporter and he loved how it played. He loved how it sounded. And that's what prompted him to ask them to change the script. And again, lots of rewrites ensued, but it was to make it a woman and to build this love story around it as well. And to make it kind of this, you know, one rom-com sold well, but to make it a little bit of this, like, kind of screwball almost esque, like It Happened One Night, of like these antics that they get up to in this process, and that he's kind of sort of trying to trick her into staying while going along with everything that she's saying, right? That he's fully supportive. He just wants her to do this one last story, yada, yada. And I love the one last story bit too. Like, I just think it's a bit that plays throughout the whole thing, but I do like the shift for it being a woman, largely because I think Rosalind Russell does an incredible job of it, but also because I love that she's at parity with all these men in the room, right? Yeah. Like, she is a newspaper man. They say it over and over and over again. She's a newspaper man. She says it later. And I love the mutual respect of her being in that room and treated the same way and treated like an equal. Even though he's her editor, he treats her like an equal really kind of throughout. He is like trying to trick her into staying for sure. But you can tell that there is, I think on the whole, a real respect for her and her skill throughout.
Yeah, no issue with it being changed to a woman. I just could do without the underlying thing being that he wants her to be with him. Not just that he wants her to be a writer, but that he is in love with her and is trying to get her to stay and like sabotage her marriage. Didn't love that.
Well, we'll get into it in a second. Yeah. So let's get through the basics. So as we said, that's the source material. It got rejiggered a little bit for the film, which has been remade a few other times. So other ways for you to watch this. But the major casting crew is Mr. Cary Grant. Again, legend, plays Walter Burns, the editor. He's been in a gazillion things. North by Northwest is one of the ones that people have probably heard. Notorious is one that people have probably heard. If you're into film noir at all, it's incredible. Charade is like a funny kind of rom-com as well. But To Catch a Thief is another great film noir. That's with Grace Kelly, which is beautiful. And also that whole, like, this is before she's Princess of Monaco whole thing. And also he as a whole, if you didn't already know, I think we've talked about this in one or more episodes before, but he's really the inspiration for James Bond, really Cary Grant, the person. And you see that in all the characters actually that he plays and his demeanor and his physicality, how he inspired Ian Fleming. So he's awesome. Love to see him. I'm so glad we picked one with him in it. Rosalind Russell, like I said, plays Hildy Johnson. She has been in a number of things. Gypsy, The Women, Auntie Mame. The Women and Gypsy, I can't remember about Auntie Mame or not, but Gypsy and The Women are both plays as well, which, to your point, on the whole, a lot of this source material is from plays. Mm-hmm. And a lot of actors at this time, especially in like the late 20s, early 30s, really went for Broadway, not Hollywood. Hollywood was like, you know, not the classier place to work of the two, right? And so a lot of the source material to get actors from the stage was play-based source material to get them to kind of take these roles seriously and take some of these jobs. She's been in, again, The Women is an incredible, another very witty, well-written play, if you've never seen it, wherein aptly named No Man Ever Shows Up. So it's a really, she's great in all of these roles and it's a really good turn for her.
It's also ironic given the situation in this film that we just mentioned of Cary Grant, Walter trying to break up Hildy's marriage, because in reality, Cary Grant actually introduced Rosalind Russell to her future husband and ended up being the best man at her wedding. And I was like, that's kind of cool considering what ends up transpiring in this 90 minutes.
Hashtag bros, man. He introduced her to her husband. I love it. We also have Ralph Bellamy, who's really the only one other one that I mentioned, mostly because, again, not very many people you're going to know here. Also, a lot of smaller bit parts. But Ralph Bellamy is a really funny and kind of meta reference in this film because he was a really uprising star, popular movie star at this time. He plays Bruce Baldwin. He was in a million things. Same thing, the studio system. He was in a gazillion things. One of the things he's most well known for being the Wolfman. But what I love about him is that his career, more than almost anybody else in this movie, went all the way into modern times. He's done, I think I looked at it, it was like 187 films, jeez, something insane. And so one of the more recent ones is he's in Pretty Woman. And he's the one that Richard Gere is trying to take over his business, like buy his business. They go, they have that like fun dinner, the four of them, that's always pretty funny. And he's the like grandfather type who he's trying to steal his business.
I'm glad to hear that, because it was getting to be sort of depressing looking at the IMDb's for these classic films and seeing, like, I mean, obviously they're almost 100 years old. A lot of these actors and actresses aren't with us anymore. And but it is interesting. I didn't see a lot of overlap in things that I might have seen them in late in their careers. So that's a cool one to know.
He actually was in several others too. So he did a lot of films in like late 80s, early 90s still. He was still a very active actor. So I thought he was worth the mention for sure. Quick plot summary, and then we'll get into it, which is a newspaper editor uses every trick in the book to keep his ace reporter ex-wife from quitting and remarrying, using an exclusive interview with a death row convict as an enticement to buy himself some time to win her back.
Also, so, you know what they should have called this movie?
What?
It Happened One Night. Because this one actually takes place in one night, not like the fucking one last week that was like a week long.
I mean, fair call out, fair complaint. It was not aptly named in that instance. That's a pretty good summary, though. I will say, again, these are almost 100 years old. We're going to get into it. Turn Around, Don't Drown. It's spoiler time. I think what's interesting, too, is that he, like, I just love all his antics. I mean, I know you don't love the love story part, but I love, like, the lengths he will go to, you know, to make sure that she has a reason to stay. You know, he's sending his reporter who's already on this gig, like on a paid vacation practically, and is like, get out of town, go do literally anything else so I can get my wife to stay here. And their whole witty repartee the whole way back and forth is like, they do, I think, complement each other really well. So even though maybe if you're not as interested in the love story, you can see why it's there. Like, I feel like they are really, they have a strong dynamic and connection and like a chemistry on the screen, of course, more than she does with Ralph Bellamy's character, which is Bruce. You know, he's just like the nice guy who's there and he's lovely and whatever, but he's not the intriguing one of the two when she's interacting
it
with
them. It feels very, to call, let's get some more Julia Roberts on the podcast, and we already mentioned Pretty Woman. It feels very My Best Friend's Wedding-y, where this character is trying to sabotage the other suitor for somebody that they have feelings for. Mm-hmm. Except in that one, I feel like at the end, she learned a lesson of, oh, it was wrong of me to not want this person who I care for to be happy. But in this, it ends with this poor guy who's been sabotaged at every, like, he's been arrested 3 times. And it is funny, like, the number of times he gets arrested in this, a good running gag. But I just this it. Poor guy finally stands up for himself. And she's not even hearing it. She's like, so, this to me reads like a tragedy. Like, it reads like a comic tragedy, where at the end it's these two bad people who are doing everything that they will to get a story, because they tell us that flat out in the opening text, not even a scroll, but they put that text up about how, you know, journalists at this time would do anything it took to get a story short of murder. And I'm like, that makes a lot more sense after you get through the end of this and realize, oh, these are not good people. Like, they are not good people.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know if they're not good people so much as they're very preoccupied people. I don't think, I can see why you would see that and why you would think that. And I think it's a valid criticism. I think what the intention is, though, to show is like, they're all about the story, right? Like, this is their life. They live and breathe the story. And that's supposed to be played for something that you would admire about them, something you would think is really interesting about them, which is that they're so dedicated to their craft. And it almost is an unhealthy dedication, but like to where she's trying to leave. She's supposed to leave on the 2 o'clock train, the 4 o'clock train, the 6 o'clock train, the 9 o'clock train. And this bitch can't leave because she's in the middle of this story that is still ongoing. And I like that. I like that you have two stories happening at once. I like that you have the story of this inmate and this story that she is genuinely trying to write and she's actually reporting on. She's really dedicated to and trying to figure it out. But you also have the story of the ways in which she's kind of being tricked throughout to stay, or, you know, being a little bit maneuvered to stay by him. And I like that those complement each other really well. And they're all like this plot forward motion. I think that's really well done.
Yeah. I mean, I don't hate all the things you just mentioned are great. I do agree. I like the framing of this as my best writer. If you take the love story out again, my best writer is leaving for happiness outside of the career that we've sort of built together. My goal is to get them to stay and then sort of hijinks ensue. I think that can be fun. But when you add in, I'm trying to ruin your upcoming marriage and have your husband arrested, but he's the bad guy because he's boring. That's not really fair. It leaves a bad taste in my mouth. But I did enjoy, if you take out the way that it ends, I enjoyed everything leading up to it. I do like how they interweave this sort of murder and how, honestly, it gets dark at times. They interweave this sort of murder trial and this execution in with political corruption and how the journalists tie into that. So I think it tells a really compelling tale of this line of work.
Well, and I think that's the thing. I think this line of work is they're supposed to be the heroes of this story, right? Like what they are doing is honorable and heroic because they're trying to save this man who didn't do the thing that he's being accused of or didn't know what he was doing for whatever reason. And you're following that story where they're kind of racing, is in their minds, they're racing against a clock to do this very important thing. And you get all these other ancillary emotions as well that complement that. And I think that you see also in juxtaposition to them, the other reporters who are taking a very different tact, right? So it's not just, oh, all reporters are heroes, right? It's these two are trying to do something really important and positive.
Okay. And the maybe way that I misread that, because I thought, like, I knew it was a conglomeration of reporters in that one area or that one set. I didn't realize that we were supposed to be juxtapositioning the good reporters with the bad reporters. I assumed they were all working together. So when Molly comes over and has that scene where she's pleading with them and trying to, like, why did you misrepresent me? And they're just sort of, you know, pushing her to the side. And then eventually they corner her and she tries to kill herself. Again, it gets dark. Kill herself because of them. I was lumping them all in together. So, but again, maybe that's, I still think that it doesn't do as good of a job at differentiating those two. I don't know.
So in that press room, so that's a courthouse press room that is where, again, the reporters go while trials are taking place or decisions are being made. So all of the reporters from all the papers go into that place. And so you hear a few digs of like, well, that's so like the Tribune. That's so like the Daily. That's so like, you know, whatever. Yeah. Like they're all, and they're at the Post, for example. So everybody is on a different paper and you're seeing them. They have a camaraderie and a respect for one another, but they're all competing to get the story. And so that's part of where they're trying to keep some of that information to themselves. You see that happen a few times of like, she wants to shut the door and have this conversation where they're not there, things like that. And it's because their goal is different than the other reporters. Their goal is to right a wrong as far as they see it. And they say that from the very beginning of the story. And this is one of the things I like about the writing is there is a callback to it at the very beginning when you see them. He's talking about, he's being asked by his printer, like, why have we gotten so political, you know? And he's like, because this is fundamentally wrong and we have to take a stand here. And that calls back to like why this story is important. And what I like about his character is that he does truly believe in this story, this saving this person and getting the job done. And he's just also simultaneously trying to win back his ex-wife. And so he's kind of marrying those two things together throughout the story. But I think the core is that they're supposed to be, these two are supposed to be the heroic ones. So the fact that she's ignoring him, to your point, she's ignoring, you know, her Bruce, who's telling her like, that's it, I'm taking a stand, I've got to go. That does, of course, like, that is hurtful and it's a rude thing to do in all the ways, but you're supposed to see it as like, she's doing the thing that's the priority because it's time sensitive and this man is on death row and she's got to do this right now. So I don't think she's supposed to be a bad person in that particular context, but I see how it's a little rough for Bruce for sure.
I think what you're saying makes sense. I'll concede that I didn't understand the entire story that was being told there. And actually I had written down later, now it makes more sense when they finally arrest Earl in the actual press room, and all the reporters are typing their stories and they're all writing different things. I wrote down that was kind of funny, of like, some people are saying the gun went off, some people are saying he shot at the police, some people are saying like, oh, he gave himself up willingly. Now that makes a little more sense that everyone's reporting what they think will get the most, I guess, whatever clicks were back in the day, eyes on it. But yeah, from the get-go, I get why it's funny, but it just seems so mean-spirited that when he takes them out to lunch, that initial meeting, and he meets with Bruce, he's like shitting on their trip to Albany. Oh, you're going to go live with mom, huh? Like, he's really rubbing her face in. Mm-hmm. Your life is going to be so much worse without me. Maybe it's another example of 1930s males, of like, women need to be told what to do, and like, they need to really see that life's gonna suck over there and they'd be better off with me. And we talked about socking on the nose and what women deserve last week, and it just that's another thing where that just hasn't aged well for me.
I hear you, and I agree with, like, it's funny though, because I take similar but different issue with it, in that I think he knows her really well, and he knows that that's not enough for her. She keeps saying, like, it almost sounds, the way she talks to herself throughout this and to everyone around her, it sounds to me like she's trying to convince herself of this, that this is what she wants. And this is what she wants to do. She wants to go live a normal life. And like, because listen, this is not a normal life. Like, we have demonstrated that, right? Being a newspaper reporter and living, you know, flying by the seat of your pants and having to live in this, you know, in this press room and chase these stories and cover these really dark topics. Like, this is not a normal life. And so she says that multiple times. She's like, I want to go live like one of the normal people. I want to live this normal life. But you see her change when the choice comes down to it, right? When it comes down to, do I actually want to go take and proceed to this normal life? If I wanted to, I would just take the fucking train and go do the thing. But what feeds me, what excites me, what gets me going, and what I know I can do well, is cover these stories and write these stories and do it with gusto and dedication. And I can get the story and I can write it well, and I love it, and it fires me up. And I think that's what you're supposed to see in her, is that it fires her up, and he knows that about her. And I hear you that it's not presented in the right way, because it's very directive of like, I'm making fun of you and your life choices, totally. But I think it comes down to him being like, girl, you're a newspaper man, you know, like, I know who you are, and who you are is not a housewife.
Yeah, there's that line where she says that, of, I'm not going to be a newspaper man, I'm going to be a woman and I'm going to raise babies. And she goes into like very much what feminism now is trying to go against, of like, I'm going to go do these predictable things and be submissive to my husband and all this. So I do like that it undoes that by the end.
Yeah, I like that she, like I said, I like that it's a woman. I like that she's accepted in these rooms. She's respected in these rooms, that she's the best of the bunch. They make reference to her writing being so strong and so well done multiple times. She's the best writer in the room, right? Including Cary Grant's character, who we're supposed to think is great, right? Mm-hmm. So I love for her that she's the best one of the bunch. And that's part of why he doesn't want her to leave. It's not, I think part of it is obviously that love story, of course. But I think part of it's like, he doesn't want her to waste her talent. This is her calling. This is what she's supposed to be doing. And I think that the trajectory of the film is you seeing that that's true. It's you, yes, he tricked her. Yes, he did it in this manipulative way that isn't great. But she realized also who she was in this process as well. And I think that part lands genuinely for me. And I love that for her. Of, I agree with you though. I will concede one big point of like, she could have not married him at the end of it, and I still would have been like, your career. Like, I'm thrilled for your career, though. Like, you realize that this is what you wanted and that you wanted to write and that this is the thing that gives you joy and passion and all these things.
Yeah, I feel like if this got remade or rewritten nowadays, you could keep almost everything the same, but maybe at the end there's a compromise where she can stay with her new husband, she can keep working her job, and she finds a happy medium. And that's just in the 30s. That wasn't the happy ending most people wanted, I guess.
No, I don't think so. But I like that we have to, again, we have to look at this in the context of the time that it was written. This is not the happy ending that most women of this era are told to want. I won't even say that they want, because who knows what they wanted, right? Like, women have had their own hopes and dreams for hundreds of years that probably didn't align with societal expectations, but you are just not told that you can want this, right? Mm-hmm. And I love that she is saying, fuck this, like, this is what I want. This is who I am. And she's just going and doing it. And she's doing it in a way that is still graceful and beautiful and respectful and feminine in a way, right? But she gets to still be a woman and be feminine and be a newspaper man. And I love that juxtaposition. Like, she says it with no irony whatsoever. And it's respected, both, like, she says it with confidence and they agree with her. And I love that for this character. I think she's one of the most interesting characters in film for that reason.
Yeah, I think I want to get into some of the positives, because I feel like I've spent the first 10 minutes like really critiquing the thing that focusing on the thing that I didn't like about this. But I want to say again.
But I hear you. I think it's fair. I think it's fair.
Well, thanks. So I think that, again, just like last week, the script in this is tight as fuck. Like, it's
240 words per minute, you guys.
Yeah. The average is what, like 90 something?
90.
Yeah, 90 words per minute is the average movie, like when you go watch a motion picture, what's on the screen, what you're hearing. This is just balls to the wall, to the point that it's honestly kind of exhausting at times. I feel like with how tight the script is, and we had the subtitles on because I was missing jokes. I was missing lines, and there's just so much happening where different characters are making little throwaway lines. Apparently they were encouraged to improvise and ad lib to fill any gaps and talk over each other. So there's a lot of funny stuff in here. And I do think it's demonstrative of the workplace that they're in. I do think it sometimes it kind of falls on its own sword because you're missing some of that. But I think that probably makes it more rewatchable, honestly, because you're picking up on all these different side plots and little characters that all sort of blend together. But yeah, the humor in this is great. I wrote down just like 10 different quotes that made me laugh. So,
well, first of all, I want to hear some of those. But second of all, I just want to add on to what you just said. I totally agree with you. The pacing of this is incredible, but it is strenuous. It's almost a strenuous watch. I do also think you have to watch it multiple times to fully appreciate it, because yes, you get all the little Easter eggs, all the little jokes that you missed the first or the second time, and you don't hear them all. But it is overlooked a little bit in a modern rewatching that this was a big deal to have people even talk over each other this way. This was only the second film ever to do it. And this way was done very uniquely. Like, they could not, there's not a multi-track system for audio at this point. They couldn't film separate scenes. They had to like catch the repartee. And a lot of it, to your point, was ad-libbed. So this was responsive mics being turned off. There were like mics being turned on and off as much as 35 times in a scene to capture who was talking at different times. So the creativity and the innovation of this, and also what I think really gives the feel of this newspaper room and this fast-paced environment that inspired this to be at the time, the fastest script ever. He was actually trying to beat the front page, and he did, but that was the goal, was be as fast as possible, cut people off. There's no score for this reason, right? There's no background score because there's no room for it. You're just talking the whole time.
I think the only music that I noticed, I think there's the opening credits, and then in like the last 3 minutes when they're having their little romantic moment, they sort of put this little swell of romantic back like track there. But that's the only music I remember hearing throughout the whole film.
Yeah. I just love, like, I think it's a very simple observation that Hawks made, and then he made a film based on it. He's like, people talk over each other. They interrupt each other. He told us he was interviewed by Peter Bogdanovich, and he went into a whole long spiel about people, when they're excited or they're arguing or they're describing something, they cut in, they jump over people, they jump to the point. They want to ask you a question while you're talking. And so they don't just wait the way you would in, say, a play to let someone finish their line and then you say your line, right?
Yeah, The poker scene is demonstrative. That was the first one where I went, oh, they're playing it. That is how it works. You're in the middle of a poker game. You're not going to stop so this person over here can make a phone call. They are continuing their conversation. They're all jumping on and off the phones, but you're still hearing talk about the poker game. It's like following three different scenarios at one time, which I kind of dug in that scene.
Yeah. And you do have to kind of pay attention. And I think subtitles are, yes, a game changer and your savior when watching this kind of movie, because there is so much. But I think it's an early iteration of this and it's been adapted so many times. I know I've mentioned this on the pod before, but Amy Sherman Palladino, Daniel Palladino have done a bunch of work that is inspired by this. This is the kind of work that they have emulated in their writing of, we want our script to be three times as long as the next one because we're just saying more, we're doing more in a shorter period of time. But it's like, you know, calisthenics with words, as Dorothy Parker would say.
Yeah. So you wanted to hear some of the lines that stood out to me.
Yes, I do. What are your faves? Because there's so many good ones.
I have literally probably 15 or 20 different quotes that just made me. I love when he says, do you have any way of stopping? Was it the train or the bus to this city to stop her from leaving, basically? And his guy just deadpans back. Well, we might dynamite it.
Yeah.
We'll blow it up. That'll stop it from taking her away.
But I love that he like considers it. He's like, could we? Yeah.
I love the call out when they're in the restaurant of like, oh, you want some rum in your coffee? It's a nasty day out. I like that logic. I love that logic on this.
It's cold out. We gotta fend off the cold. I love it.
The, can you move the hanging up to 5 a.m.? Why not hang him at 5 instead of 7? And he's like, well, I can't hang a man in his sleep.
Yeah. He's not going to be awake yet, obviously.
Yeah. Let's see. I know I'm just rattling these off. So sorry if this isn't fun, guys, but these are,
it's fun for me. Let's go.
I don't even know if this was meant to be comedic. I assume it was, but we get the whole thing and I want to hear your two cents on the Earl storyline and what exactly that, cause I might've missed some of the details on that going through, because you are hearing all these different interpretations of just, was he guilty? Was he a man who was just pushed too far or put in the wrong scenario? And then when they have all the psychologists coming in and like grilling him over and like basically he's being sleep deprived. And I think that's why he ends up going crazy. I think that's what I was supposed to draw from that. But when he's sitting there being interviewed and he's just like, I'm awful tired. Can I go back to jail again? That line killed me as well. Mm-hmm. And there's lots more.
He's so worn out by the end of it. And I think part of what you're supposed to take away from him is that he's quite simple and he doesn't understand the context that he's put in multiple situations, including but not limited to the gun. And also that he didn't know that the gun was loaded and he used it the way that it is functionally supposed to be used. So it's supposed to be implied that he doesn't realize what he did. You know, he doesn't really fully conceptualize it, and that they are trying to save him from the death penalty for that reason. Like, not to say he didn't do something wrong, but that he shouldn't be put to death because he didn't like vindictively murder someone is kind of the premise there.
Okay.
But that at this time, and it's very interesting if we were to look at this in reference to now, at this time, it's because the person that he shot was a quote unquote colored. So African American.
That's another one that, yeah.
Police officer. 1930s. Oh, yeah. Gross. Sorry. I apologize. But that will score political points if we put to death the man that killed a black man is the implication here. And it's not about him actually being guilty or responsible for his actions. It's that this is going to get the mayor reelected.
Yep.
Yeah, he needs a black vote if he's going to get reelected. And so he wants, and this is, you know, there's the tale as old of time of Chicago corruption, and that this mayor is corrupt, and that's the only reason that they would do this.
And not to make light of all that darker stuff that we just talked about, but I do like how they end up making light afterward when Earl escapes, and they're like, well, who let him out? And he goes, well, maybe the sheriff let him out so that he could vote for him. That callback was great. I'm just, oh, this sheriff sucks. No one likes this guy.
I just love, yeah, all the shit talking. I love a bunch of, there's so many other good lines. I like the, I personally really love the Hildy Walter dynamic. Like the shit talking back and forth throughout mm-hmm. is awesome to me. I love when she's like, Walter, you're wonderful in a loathsome sort of way. Like what a compliment, what a line. Like I just, I love that.
I like it's that. Great. And I like how well, I mean, you already spoke about how well he knows her, but also mm-hmm. how it's demonstrated how well she knows him and how he is mm-hmm. constantly trying to scam and con Ralph. And she says, you know, put the check in your hat, not in your pocket. Cause yes, his, you know, all his money gets stolen when he's arrested the first time. So she knows that this is going to not play out well for Ralph. So I like that they sort of two sides of the same coin there.
Yeah. I like that. She's the woman about town here. You know what I mean? She's the woman who knows the lay of the land and knows, you know, how to survive in this context and in this city and in these kind of darker, more difficult situations. And I like that it's her really giving the roadmap and not the men in the room, in any room. And I think that she's like, she plays that so well as the person who can really hold her own in any room, in any space. And it's really likable. I also really like that. There's about the money thing that goes back and forth, and she's trying to get the money back from Walter at one point, and he goes, "What do you think? I'm a crook?" And she goes, "Yes." Like I just like,
well, he's literally doing the con in the restaurant. Like after working in retail for so many years, that was something we were told to look out for. Was just people will intentionally try to confuse you with, "Hey, can you break this dollar?" Or actually, "No, can I give you this and you give me a 20 back?" Mm-hmm. And fuck mm-hmm. with you to try and make money. And he tries to pull that. And she warns Ralph of it, or not Ralph, Bruce. It's funny that I said that because I wanted to call out that fact that they have that throwaway line where he says, "Go find that guy. He looks like Ralph Bellamy."
He looks like Ralph Bellamy, so which was ad-libbed, by the way, by Cary Grant. So way
fun
to
that
go.
They left that in of like using the actor's name. Another Julia Roberts, Ocean's 12. We're 3 for 3 mm-hmm. on Julia Roberts references. Oh, she looks just like Julia Roberts.
We've had a lot of those lately. I feel like we got to just do one of hers because we're leading up to it. I'm convinced. Yeah. I love all the lines. I love the writing for this. I think I think what I really enjoy is that she, like I said, it feels for me like a story more about her making a decision to do the thing that she loves than it is a love story. And I mean, maybe that's why that doesn't like, I know that it's there, but it doesn't like stand out to me as being the point of the story. You know, to me, the point of the story is this woman who's discovering her calling and leaning into it and deciding to do the thing that she's excellent at. And I love that they read some of her writing and it sounds really, it's beautiful and it's well done. And also I love that she's like supporting Molly later, and she calls out the men in the room for their bad behavior too. I like that she doesn't just go along to get along. Like she'll tell anybody in any room exactly what she thinks and do what she thinks is the right thing. And I love that for her as a character.
I feel like we should watch at some point, we should cover Whiplash, because I'd be curious to know how you read the ending of that, because I think that and this are very similar, where you can read it as being a completely happy ending, or you can read it like I did, of being kind of a tragedy.
As in the Damien Chazelle Whiplash?
Yes, yes.
Film. I fucking love that movie.
It's one of my favorites of the last decade, but I feel like the endings are very similar. If you have these two prolific people pushing each other and they're going to do great things, but like, how do you really read it? How much they're sacrificing in honor of that? So just curious.
Yeah, there's a lot there. Yeah. Especially in that one, I think there's a lot there to unpack. And I think like, but I think what we come back to here is, there are some very dark things. There's a lot of references to Hitler, for example, in this film. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and I mean like not as throwaways as in like, we're telling the world what we think of Hitler at this time. He's a bad guy, but it's just like this underpinning of this story that there's all these really dark, there's this corruption in Chicago. There's Hitler who is awful. There's this murder that has happened. This woman jumped out of a window, you know, like all these things are a little bit normalized in this particular context, because this is the nature of the beast, right? Like this is the nature of this job and this career. And like, it's
Molly
kind of
jumps
almost
out the window. And that was another thing, was just Molly jumps out the window and Walter is just like, who gives a shit about her? Where's Earl? Which I get, he's going for the story, but it just reads so callous. So sorry to interrupt. You were saying.
No. I think that's a great point. I mean, there's some dark things happening here that get made into a joke because of the context, is I guess what I'm saying. Like, the point of this is to report on the story, and it's not about the dark things that are happening. Like, even Molly, she has the line about, like, if it was worth breaking my nails, I'd tear your face off, right? Like, there's just all these little, like, snarky one-liners that are so great, while then, yes, something really dark or something really hard happens. But I think it comes down to, like I said, I think it's supposed to be, it's a little bit of this love story, but I do also think it's this, you know, coming, not of age, but to this realization, like, or this sense of self for Hildy on the whole.
Yeah.
And I love that growth for her. And I do think it ends pretty funny. My one complaint is that she kind of like just kind of goes with the flow at the end there. Like, to your point, if you wanted to argue that the love story feels forced, it feels like she just at the end realizes that they're going to just do that. Right. Like, that he's like, we're going to get remarried. Ugh. And she's like, okay, yeah. You know, like, she just kind of, she does kind
of, that was an impulsive noise. I'm sorry to make that noise about one of your favorites, but that moment when he's like letting her go, I think that last conversation is pretty touching when he's like, go on, go, I'll write the story. You got a better life, blah, blah. And it's like, that feels the most genuine, maybe not genuine, feels like for once they're outside of their professional dynamic. And he's
letting her leave now. Like, he's come to realize, like, this is maybe not okay. The thing I've been kind of fooling around all day, I didn't mean it. Like, if this is what you want, go do it. It does feel like he's finally deferring. Like, I'm sorry. Go do what you need to do.
Yeah. I'm like, that plays really well. But then the moment when she realizes he's fucking with Bruce again, and she goes, oh, I just had to know that you wanted him arrested and you actually loved me. I just wanted to be chased. I'm like, that does not read well for any woman of like, I just needed to know that you were chasing after me, and that makes all this other stuff okay. That I did not enjoy.
I don't love that. I do also feel like she wouldn't bring Bruce back. She wouldn't even come back if that wasn't part of what she wanted to do. Yeah. And I know, and I'm not saying that in any kind of judgment, right? I think this is somebody who knows that her life is here and that this is what she actually wants, and it didn't work out the last time. And so while he is manipulating her and trying to maneuver her all day, I think that's what that is supposed to tell you, is that she is doing the same. And ultimately they're the same. They're very much made for each other because they're doing the same things to each other. She only brought Bruce here to show off. She only made a show of leaving because she wanted him to see her leave. It's like slamming a door really extra loud to make sure they hear, right? She wants him to know that she's moving on and she's going to go do this thing that not only is not the person that he has seen her be, but is the opposite of everything that he loves about her. And she's giving him the middle finger to this life that she had with him, to make a stink of it, to be a rejection of this relationship that had failed before. And she wants him to really feel it. Like, I think she is just as much participating in this as he is. And that's part of why they complement each other so well. And poor Bruce, admittedly, caught in the crossfire of these antics.
I'm in agreement that I think they are both equally guilty, but I don't know if that's for a first time watcher. I'd have to I will rewatch
this. It's hard. No, I agree with you. I don't think it's
presenting that way. It seems as though she is making this decision of, I need to get out of this business and away from this man because I know I'm not, I don't know if it's a good person. Like, this is keeping from being a good person or living my best life. That's how it read to me at the start. So for her to get pulled back into it, and yes, this is where she does her best work, but is this being the best person she can be? That's the way that I interpret. I wish they would have addressed more clearly, because I think you do a great job of calling out, like, yeah, she's fucking with him just as much as he's fucking with her, and Bruce is the victim in all this. But I think they could have made that a little clearer, I think.
And I think it's, to be fair, to your point, there's so much going on. Like, again, if you haven't,
film. It is an exhausting really not just the words per minute, but there's just so much fucking happening throughout this.
There's so much. And you know what's cool about that, to me at least, is like, there's not fucking action. These are not action sequence. No. There's like plot happening every second of this movie. There is plot, there are words, there are things. And like, I just find that fascinating. And I love like, I, again, I just keep the Dorothy Parker quote keeps popping into my head. It's like, it's calisthenics with words. Like, it is a fucking workout to watch this movie and to be in this movie, like to present this story. This is a lot happening all in one fell swoop. But I really enjoy it. I love my brain having to work that fast. I love having to keep up that with that story that quickly. I can't remember if on the first watch I thought, I'm sure I didn't think all of this was clear, but I wonder what resonated the most on the first watch and if it was similar. But I do think it's one of those things that as you keep watching it, you pick up more and more, if nothing else, more and more of the humor, because it is so funny. It's very, very
funny. There's a lot going on. Like I said, a bit exhausting. I was watching the clock a little. I forget what I was doing after I was watching this, but I assumed I was like an hour and 10 minutes into the movie, and mm-hmm. I looked and 40 minutes had passed. And then I looked again and thought, oh, okay, it's probably been another 20 minutes. It had been five. Like, there's just so much happening at any given moment. It was hard to take notes, which, you know, that's unrelated to watching a movie. But yeah, there's a lot I didn't love at the beginning. I was like, is this how divorced couples talk? Where you, I don't know, Mackenzie, do you just give a little exposition of here's what we loved about our relationship, but here's what we didn't love, and here's why we broke up every time you meet up with them? Just, I didn't love that scene, honestly.
Well, in the interest of keeping things that I probably shouldn't share publicly on the pod private, I would say, yeah, that can happen.
Okay. I remember the time that we went to Universal Studios and how much fun we had.
Weirdly, like, I know that seems like that's not the way people talk, but sometimes, especially when they're trying to pull at your heartstrings, it can be the way that people talk, I think. But yeah, I do think that is so true in a film, though. Like, you have this exposition that feels like this is for plot. This is for you to get some background out of this more than anything else, for sure.
Yeah. The most emotional two moments of this, clearly, when Walter fakes crying and then nudges Bruce to get him to look up and see that he's fake cry. I thought that was a brilliant little gag.
I love that. It's so funny. He's like, wait a minute. Hey, pay attention. I'm putting on the performance of my life here, fella.
And then the meanest fucking thing in this film, a film full of like what I would consider bad people and mean acts. The meanest thing, the thing that cuts the deepest is, so do you always carry an umbrella? That is the roast of the fucking century. In the 1930s, that's like Kendrick Lamar going after Drake. Like, that is just, his career's over. That guy's done, Bruce.
The roast.
Yeah.
Which, I love his response. It's so earnest. He's like, it looked a little cloudy, you know? Like, what do you mean? Yeah. It's so, it's so well done. There are lots of little burns there. I love Cary Grant's little like, hey, watch me.
Look at me. I'm crying. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I love his I love all of his one-liners, and I actually like that he, again, he's a little bit ancillary, but where he comes in is always, he kind of steals his scenes that he's in. You know, you spend a lot more time with Hildy and even the other reporters than you do with Cary Grant's character. But every time he comes in, you're glued to the screen and what he has to say. And it's just, yeah, he's dynamic. He's so dynamic. Okay, well, all that to say, I think this is something that you have to watch more than once to really enjoy, just because, again, it really is a lot in one watch. I think it's very funny and all the things. But what would you say is your rating?
I think, to your point, I'm going to have to rewatch it at some point, because clearly, like, I misinterpreted at least two things that were sort of holding back my rating of this. So I'll give it a little bit of, like, leniency because of that, because I can admit when I just missed this, because I was trying to mm-hmm. track a million things in this film and also take mm-hmm. notes at the same time. So I do think it's good. I think the script is incredibly tight, and for what it's doing, like, it is just a mile a minute, a joke every 10 seconds, yep. a million things to keep track of. For that being said, I do still think it still drags a little for me at times, because like I said, it's like watching a stage play. If we're in this one room for 20 minutes of the film,
yeah.
and there's one scenario playing out, but because they're talking so fast, it feels just like a lot to get through. But I think there is one shot where I went, oh, that's different. And that's the one where Hildy is on the two phones near the end.
Oh, and she's going back and forth, scene.
But the camera follows her a little bit. It's panning just like 6 inches just each time. And I'm like, that is a pretty cool early movie trick. So I dug that a lot.
I love that scene. That's one of my favorite scenes. She does an incredible job with that.
Yeah. So all that to say, really funny. Do recommend for a first watch. I came out of it, honestly, at about a 6. But I'm going to bump it up a little bit to acknowledge, you know, where I had some misinterpretations today. I'll go to like, I'm not going to go all the way to a 7. Not this first watch, but I will rewatch it. So I'll go like, I'm going to do this for the first time, quarter points. 6.75, because I don't want to give it a 6.5. I'm going to go 6.75, acknowledge that I need to watch it again, but don't love the moral of the story unless it is a tragedy. And I guess it's my right to determine if that's how I watch the movie, right?
I was going
to
say, maybe it is a tragedy for you. Yeah. And maybe it's, you know, maybe if you watch it as a tragedy, maybe you'll like it even better. Who knows?
There you go. Yeah.
Well, that's very interesting. Yeah, I would love to hear what your thoughts are after a second watch. But I hear, like, I think some of your, again, I really love this movie. I love the writing of this movie. I love the pacing of this movie. But I hear your concerns and critiques. I think that they're fair. I, on the whole, take away, like, again, I think this is this very feminist story for her. And I love her as a depiction and her character. And it really upends its own title, right? His Girl Friday, Girl Friday is like an errand girl. If you didn't already know this, this is supposed to be almost dismissive. It's like, it's not that important of a person. And I love that she's integral to this story, to this paper, to this man. She has made herself indispensable to any and all folks as a part of the story. And she just really upends your expectations as a woman on film at this time. And she has such gumption and gravitas, and I love her. So I love this movie. I think it's like easily an 8.5 for me. I think it's worth another watch. I love the fast pacing too. Like, I love having to adjust to that pacing. No, you can't do it all the time. It does get exhausting. I hear you.
I'm also going to throw out another alternate ending for you, because I thought about it and I was like, who says she has to end up with either guy? Maybe the ending could have been that she just loves the job. She's not going to move to Albany with, she realizes, you know, that was just a life that she
Albany
didn't actually
is lame.
Want.
I'm so glad she doesn't.
I fly into Albany anytime. Like, Janelle and I always fly into Albany. Don't want to spend a lot of time there. So I get it. But maybe she says, I'm going to stay here, but like, we're not getting back together. This is purely a professional. I love what I do. I'm good at what I do. That could be a fun ending too.
Which I think if you made that movie in 2024, that would be what would happen. Right. Like, I think if you made that movie right now, that's what would happen. And I think that would be a great story. But I got to say, I think the last line in this movie is the fucking funniest thing, where he's like, I wonder if Bruce can put us up when they go to Albany. Like, it is so hilarious. Poor Bruce. But I just love that he even says it. I also love that it only happened because somebody shot and cut Hawks's ending on a different soundstage in the same week, and he had to change the ending at the last minute. So, fun fact for you.
What was the other ending?
It was going to be a different story about how basically she was like, they were going to say something about, what were they going to say? They were going to get married. I think they were going to actually do the vows, is what it was. And they were going to show that. But the way that they were going to do the actual marriage scene was going to be interesting. And then he had told someone about this, and they went and shot it on their stage for a different film. And he found out after the fact. So he had to go and change, like, in the same week, change the ending. And that's how we get that line of, I wonder if Bruce can put us up.
You can't trust people in Hollywood, man. Don't give anybody your ideas.
Don't share that information, guys, for sure. Anywho, well, thank you for riding along with me. This is one of my faves. I hear what you're saying, though. I hope you watch it again. And thank you guys for listening and riding along. Hopefully you watched it as well.
Yeah. Again, worth watching. Same thing I said last week. Absolutely watch it. Even if you're not a classic cinema person, I think it does a lot of things early that you are commonplace nowadays. But 90 years ago, this was very original.
Yeah, I think that's the thing. Any of these that we watched this month, I think that's I would recommend if you watch any of these along with us to keep that in mind, is like, this is maybe the first time you're seeing the things that we're talking about, right? Like, they're just not, this is not commonplace yet. And that's why it was so impactful and is a good time. And also, I have 1 million other classic film recommendations that I will share with y'all at some point over the course of the month in a story or something or what have you. We'll see. But come back next week where we are going to talk about, I can't remember. Are we doing All About Eve or are we doing Maltese Falcon first?
All About Eve is one of your favorites, right?
That is one of my faves.
Do you want to save that for the last
ep? Yeah, let's save that for last. Okay, so come back next week where we're going to talk about the Maltese Falcon, which is our Humphrey Bogart entry of the month, which we had to have at least one. So,
and that was the one where I went, oh, I know that title. I've heard that title. I picked that one in Mackenzie's. He didn't listen to last week's episode.
It's okay, though. It checks a lot of boxes. We need some Humphrey Bogart. We need some film noir. Like, it's going to be great. You guys have also probably heard of it. So that'll be good for sure. But in the meantime.
Follow us on our socials. We drink and we watch things on Instagram, TikTok. You can check out our reels, our stories, all that good stuff. Also, you can email us questions, suggestions, future movies at wedrinkandwewatchthingspod@gmail.com. And yeah, you can watch video now on YouTube. Subscribe there. We drink and we watch things. And Spotify now does video. So if you want to see our beautiful faces whilst you listen, don't do it while you're driving, please. You will get an accident.
Somebody sent me a picture of them doing it while they were driving, by the way. And
straight
I was, one, like, you're going to get a ticket. And two, I was mortified. I was like, my whole ass face on your console? Don't recommend.
It's not an ass face, Mackenzie. It's pretty good.
Thanks. All right, homies. Thanks for hanging with us. But for now, go have a drink and watch a thing. Cheers.